Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92 here in Seattle. And this is the Veterans Radio Show broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. This show is going to be a tutorial basically on counter-recruiting and using experience that the Chapter 92 has acquired during over the last few years. And specifically, we will mention that we have access to the Seattle School District in particular through the good work of Kathy Barker and Amy Hagopian years past, which ended up with the school district instituting some protocols for people and particular recruiters visiting Seattle schools. Part of that protocol is that whenever the recruiters visit the schools, the people offering alternative points of view, including Veterans for Peace, shall be allowed to attend at the same time. So, this piece will be a little addition to the one I already recorded, but basically, I'll talk about the military IQ test, which is a test which we use when we go into schools and talk to students about their information that they need for if they're considering enlistment. And it's information about the military, the liabilities of joining the military and war, military pollution, and militarism in general, but particularly liabilities of joining the military that students are really often not aware of. And it's certainly not information that the recruiters are going to tell them. It's recruiters have in the past lied to students about benefits and liabilities of joining the military. These days, it's not so much outright lies as lies of omission. That is, when students ask them about educational benefits, they don't say, you don't mention that you have to have 36 months active duty to qualify for the maximum benefit, that military, for women anyway, is a very fraught experience. Military justice is not very good justice when it comes to women, especially women who are experiencing sexual harassment and/or sexual assault. At least 30%, according to the DoD statistics, are women who have been sexually assaulted and/or abused during the military. Makes it a very dangerous place for the military. Anyway, this broadcast would be useful for not only people who are new to counter-recruiting, but also to hopefully chapters that are doing counter-recruiting work. And the military IQ test and the questions therein are useful tools, and we'll talk about more of this in the rest of the recording. But it's a useful tool to talk to students and engage them about joining the military. We think it's one of the more useful things that we've actually come across, and we stick to sort of the issues of liabilities and of joining the military. We're not talking about the good parts of that joining the military. That's well covered by the military's own propaganda. But we believe it's a responsibility of the school, which is the Seattle School District, actually partially allows and subscribes to. That is, if the students have a right to this information, and if they're not getting it from the military recruiters, which they're not, then it's an obligation for the school, and then through us through the school, to make these presentations to students. Joining the military can be a life, very life-threatening sort of thing, including the choice to maybe kill or be killed, something that you might have to live with for the rest of your life, to say nothing of it, of any sort of disability that you might occur in military service, like PTSD, physical wounds, that sort of thing. So with that introduction, again, this is on KODX 96.9 FM. This information is also available, as will be mentioned again, on the VFP92.org website, which has a downloadable version of the military IQ test and also links to the Seattle School District policies concerning recruiters. You could actually go to the Seattle School District websites and look for a little bit more detailed information on how they manage recruiter visits. So hopefully this will satisfy the requirements for length on this for links on this podcast for this on this for this radio segment. Okay. So this is Veterans for Peace, Chapter 92, Seattle, Daniel Gilbert, or Daniel Ellsberg chapter. And this recording is for tutorial, really, for people thinking of joining or getting involved in counter recruiting, and or just some background on how VFP got involved and through the Seattle School District. The form that we use for in contacting students is military IQ test, which we're talking about right now, and the information on that test is available through VFP92.org, or which is our chapter website. So Dan was talking about, and I talked about the first question on the chat, the when you enlist in the military, that it is 8 years total time. So, is the military a good place to learn a skill or a career when I get out? And do you want to say something about that, Deborah?
A lot of the students take the ASVAB in high school and talk about, what career paths they see. And what I discovered is that, number one, you aren't guaranteed any of those career paths. You might be best suited to be a medic, but if your ship is in dry dock in Bremerton, Washington, you're going to be chipping paint and doing fire watch while it's in dry dock, or wherever they need you. So that's one thing about that question. The other one that I think is a problem with that is that a lot of the folks we see standing out on the street with a cardboard sign asking for help are people who got trained in the military, and then it did not translate into a civilian job. So I found this was a question that really allowed us to talk about career paths. Even when I got out of the Navy, I'd done 6 years as a staff judge advocate and as a criminal lawyer for the Navy, and a lot of people just thought all I did was march around, and I didn't get a job offer until I applied with the Pierce County prosecutor, who was a retired Army JAG, and he knew that I had pretty good legal experience. So a lot of people don't understand that your skills can translate. And that's one thing we talked about with
Yeah,
kids.
well, I remind students or tell them, says, in in the military, if you're in a combat unit or a combat arms unit, and if you spend 2 or 3 or 4 years, or in the case particularly for Iraq and Afghanistan vets, they spent 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 tours in a combat zone, learning how to fire an M4 automatic weapon or shooting people for I don't know how long you do that is not really useful sort of training to be a civilian person, unless maybe you're going to work for the Los Angeles Police Department. That's a joke. No.
Yeah, I got it.
Well,
Yeah.
and the students, they get information about the military from the military, usually. There's lots of ads about joining the military, and that's one of the things that the military, especially the Army, I think, emphasizes, that this is going to result in getting a skill, a career path that will set you for life. And certainly there are some jobs in the that you get in the military that are like that. But like Mike, you were saying, if you're an infantry person or a artillery or, just a lot of the jobs that make the military run, they're not jobs that are going to
Translate.
help you when you get out. And Deborah, you pointed out the kind of the unemployment of a lot of military, and there's also the case of homelessness of a lot of military. They're both of those statistics are sometimes double of the civilian population. So I think you can see the result in those two statistics about
Well,
homelessness and unemployment of military veterans.
that sort of leads us right into question number three, and which is how many women in the military are sexually assaulted? And as a JAG officer, former JAG officer, Deborah, you probably have substantial experience with this, dealing with that on a legal basis. The answer that we give is more than 30%. The statistics that we use are from the Department of Defense, and that is probably an undercount.
I believe so. I
Yeah.
believe so.
So, what is your experiences quickly about
Well, I personally represented, I was involved in cases where a sailor was charged with rape some by another sailor. I know I had a couple of those cases, and I had a case where an officer brought to me sexual harassment. I think it is, I would say it's more rampant in the military than in civilian life. So that's something you have to be careful about, because still women are a tiny minority still in military life, and right now they're not truly appreciated, I would say. So I would say that it's a dangerous path to take.
Well, I had a conversation. I've had several conversations with Kelly Wadsworth, who used to be a chapter member. She's actually on the national board of VFP 92, and we're talking about what commands can do about sexual assault. And it was her opinion. She's a captain, a chaplain captain, in a combat unit, and she said that if some of these company commanders started court-martialing and disciplining people, it would stop right away. Say, or just have a
Yes.
stand, do not do this in my command, I will court-martial you. And
Right.
that
But they
would
don't.
stop it. That would stop it. But they don't want to do that. Although
In this.
even now they've got protocols for it to go outside the chain of command. I don't know how useful that really is, but
Well, I have to say that in the sexual harassment case, I advised the woman to go directly to the commandant of the shipyard, and he backed her up. But he didn't take any action against the guy. He just said he had a word with him. They were officers. He had a word with him and said, "You report to me. It's not going to impact your career." But when you're enlisted, and you're trying to be one of the team, I think you're really vulnerable to this kind of treatment. So I think that's a statistic that people should be aware of.
yeah, that your command is not necessarily going to back you up. Or if he does, they do take some sort of thing and probably won't do anything about it, especially if you're making a complaint against your company commander.
Superior.
So,
Yeah.
and number four is, what service-related health issues do soldiers often experience? And the answers are A, lung disease, PTSD, heart attacks, back problems. It's probably all of those. But one of the things the recruiters don't even bother to talk about is, say, PTSD. And for women, say, who are have been in combat, they've got the trauma associated with combat, but also being sexually assaulted. So it's like a double whammy that some women, anyway, in the military have to deal with.
Yes, that's true. But the I think the age group that they're appealing to have that sense of invincibility, and I think they should be aware of especially the brain injuries that have been plaguing people, so yeah, I think it's a good question to start the conversation on.
I had a conversation not too long ago with my primary care doc, and he said that these modern soldiers, I mean, in the last 20 years or so, the gear that they carry just walking around, if they're in combat, is their armor, their weapons, their associated, clips and that sort of thing, hand grenades, is that he said that they've got an epidemic of arthritis in 30-year-olds that shouldn't be they shouldn't have this kind of arthritis until they're at least 70 or so, and that's because they're jumping out of vehicles and planes with 60 pounds of gear on, and their knees and their backs are suffering because of it. It is he describes it as an epidemic, and it's something that the VA has to deal with. Because and when you get stressed out like that, your muscles, it's once they're stressed, they don't really ever come back to 100%.
Wow.
You're always dealing with that. Anyway, that's an aside for
Well, this is a question that most of the kids, students get right.
yeah.
They've heard of PTSD, and a lot of them know what those letters stand for. But TBI, not so much. They haven't heard of that one and don't know
What's
what that
TBI,
was.
Dan?
Traumatic brain
Yeah.
injury, which was common in Afghanistan-Iraqi war, where they planted the roadside bombs that blew up vehicles and affected their brain, concussions and worse. I talk about it being something that's through had different names through different wars in the past, but it's something that is pretty common to military veterans, the trauma that they experience in the middle military. And it's something that, often with them the rest of their lives.
And it's well, it's like a concussion protocol. It doesn't show up necessarily right away. But it could stay. If you've got a traumatic brain injury, it doesn't always show up right away, but it can show up later and manifests itself with cognitive issues. You can't remember. You can't lapses and that sort of thing. It's very, very common in as you mentioned, in Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans, because they got blown up a lot. Number five is if I delay, if I sign up for the delayed entry program, can I back out or stop going in? If I signed up for delayed entry, can I back out of going in? This is one of these questions that it's sort of a contract that people can sign before, mostly usually in high school, and it's theoretically a contract, but in over 30 years or 40 years of actually this being implemented, no one has ever been forced to go into the military, that is, stand up and say, I do, because you're in the delayed entry. So it is not something that you have to say, and you can back out of this at any time. I just like to say that this is something that I've asked recruiters, like many of these questions. Recruiters are, I think, lie a less little less than they used to, but they're not going to tell people unless they're asked if they can back out of the delayed entry program. And this is something that's also true for, they're not going to talk about sexual harassment in the military. They're not going to talk about PTSD in the military. So it's a really important thing to emphasize that you don't have to say, you don't have to go into, recruiters have in the past saying, well, you signed up for the delayed entry, but you have to go into the army. And some people who didn't want to have ended up in the military. It's again one of those things that they won't necessarily tell you. DEP is so-called is kind of like a grooming program, because you get, I think you get another unless I mean you get another grade before you enlist if you go in the D. I think you end up as a E2 maybe. If when you go into the military instead of an E1. So, anything to add about that, Dan?
Just that, it's the difference between signing an enlistment contract and what you sign as that you're intending to go into the military. It's really two different things, and it's not, the. It's kind of a pre-enlistment program, often for underage kids, underage students, and but you're right. That's what recruiters are not going to tell them about that. So that's certainly why we have it on the test, so that the students know that it's not they're not obligated to continue. To enlist if they change their mind.
Okay,
The other way
so
goes too.
go ahead.
The military isn't obliged to take them if they don't pass the physical and other there are other elements that have to be met before they can actually be sworn in. So I think they need to know it's an
Works both
it's
ways.
an indication of intention, but it's not a binding contract.
Right.
Well, you mentioned about military service generally. The students who go in, about at least 25% of the people who enlist in the military don't complete their tour of enlistment for various reasons, maybe some disciplinary reasons, some health reasons, some psychological reasons. There are a bunch of reasons, but that's important because one of the catches or the enticements to go into the military is in your educational benefits. And unless you spend 36 months active duty, you don't get the full GI Bill. It can be prorated, but you don't get the full ride unless you spend 36 months. And as the latest statistics I got from the Department of Defense is a quarter, fully a quarter, if not more, of people who enlist don't get their full enlistment. So, number six is, on average, how many military and veteran suicides occur daily? That's kind of an important one of the more important ones and the kids, actually, I don't know, my experience, we've been doing this for about 5 or 6 years now, and so we've got quite a bit of a background or it says 2 years, 8 years, or 2 year, two, two, eight, 12, or 20 suicides. The correct answer is 20, or if not more. That sort of fluctuates a little bit. And those suicides are a direct result of their military service.
And there's another element that has been shown to impact that statistic as well, and that is access and knowledge of ways to end your life. They show that communities that have high gun ownership have higher suicide statistics too. And so it makes and For instance, veterinarians have a higher suicide statistic than a lot of other professions because they have the means to put down a large mammal, for instance. And so it's a number of factors that are all compounded for military members, a number of factors that I think raise that statistic, and to me, it's a horrifying statistic, but I think
Yeah.
kids should know about that when they're considering that option.
Yeah, I always bring it back to the PTSD, TBI, the physical and mental problems that occur from the military, not just in combat, but from being in the military, makes those rates so high. And then, you could also talk about moral injury
Yeah.
at this point is can be a factor for some veterans, active duty members.
And moral injury, Dan, can you tell me what that is?
Well, it's a bit different than PTSD in that it goes to a violation of your upbringing in what's right and wrong and what you feel is morally correct and not. And certainly, as people go through a basic training, they're moral compass is, the military has to kind of override that through the basic training where they teach you how to kill and emphasize that in their slogans and in their chants, at least That's what my experience. And so it often happens after what you see or what you experience or what you do in the military that brings that back to you and causes real crisis of conscience.
That is now a accepted part of the DSM, the Diagnostics DSM manual, for which is the psychiatric manual for judging people's mental health that the VA uses and others. It's a standard sort of thing, and that's an accepted sort of diagnosis. And it's not just, say, being shooting people or watching people get shot. But just being in the military and knowing what the military is doing, I mean, if you're loading bombs, if you're, military is, if you're not shooting people or actually watching people get shot, you're helping somebody else do that in one way or the other. That's what the military is. There's no getting out of being a part of the supply chain in war, and that's a that is part of the moral injury psychology, that you know that you're part of a organization that's killing people. And often, in the case of certainly the last 50 or 60 years of wars that we've been involved in this country, killing of many, many, many civilians, millions in Vietnam, tens of thousands in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you don't have to be driving a tank or something like that to know that's the most dangerous part of being in a war is being a civilian. So anyway, moral injury, but also just the wear and tear of being in the military. You are typically in the military, or often you can be, certainly if you're in a war, that you're on 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's stateside, maybe it's probably less than that, but you're required to be on duty all the time. And even for a young person, that can be very trying, physically trying. So number seven is, since World War II, how many defensive wars have the U.S. fought? And many of the kids get that wrong, because the answers, suggested answers, are none, four, six, or 10. And the word, the important word in that, is defensive. The United States hasn't fought a defensive war since the British went and burned our capital in 1812. So we're involved in the Middle East since for the last almost 40 years, but longer than that actually. And those aren't defensive wars.
Well, we say since World War II
Yeah.
in our question. I mean, some people would argue about that, I guess. But, we were attacked. And so we
We
talk
also
about.
had congressional declaration of war in World War II. So there's that part. But since then, we haven't had a
Well, I mean,
declaration.
the argument about, say, Afghanistan in the 9/11 was that we d identified training bases where some of these people had come to attack, trained to attack the United States, and we bombed the hell out of them. But then we went and invaded Iraq or Afghanistan and stayed there for 20 years. So, and then in the case of Iraq, the so-called excuse for going in there was all bogus intelligence and trumped-up sort of reasons and what have you, that there weren't any WM weapons of mass destruction. And
And that's been shown over and over.
that's one of the reasons that people who were in the military or had been in the military, they, as I did, felt that they were lied to. You went to the war on a patriotic sort of reason that I'm going to defend the country, and you find out that in the case of, well, almost every war, that the information you're given is incomplete or a lie, an outright lie, you know. For me, and for, I think it's for other people too, is that if you're getting out of the service and you're sort of asking, well, what did I do? Well, what was I a part of, you know, and what is my responsibility with all that? You kind of look in the mirror, and that can be a very hard sort of look sometimes. I was part of this military that has caused all these deaths, mainly civilian deaths. So.
Right. It's a chance to talk about, you know, what their reason for going into the military is, or their motivation. You know, are they really buying the propaganda of we're fighting for freedom and democracy? You know, when we haven't done a had a defensive war since World War II. So, you know, how is the U.S. using its military? What are we fighting for? Is this something you really want to be part of? Because what we do is go over to other countries, invade them, try to overthrow their government, kill hundreds of thousands or millions of civilians, and then we leave. And have no adequate solution to what we started. And so, you know, is this something you want to be part of? And is it something you're willing to die for? Because that's, you know, that's what war's about, you know, putting your life on the line. And even though you might have a job that's not up on the front doing the combat, we know from the last question we ask that nothing is guaranteed, and depending on military needs, you could be in a position that you could get killed, or you might have to kill somebody else. And so it's really a crucial question to get them thinking about their motive for going into the military, and if it's really something that they think deserves to be they think is worth doing.
Well, also, I think I like to mention, or not emphasize, that it's an obligation for every citizen in this country to analyze why we are going to wars, and what our military is doing. In a democracy, that's an obligation. In the military, though, yeah, they want to say you have to follow orders, but as we've seen from some recent brouhaha, some senior officers have said you it's a le very legal and required sort of thing to disobey or not follow through on illegal orders. And if what you're doing is killing a lot of civilians, that's not part of the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, or it's part of the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention on Governing War and Military is a part of U.S. law. I mean, the Geneva Conventions are U.S. law. It's international law. It's part of U.S. law. So,
Well, and we're signatory to the United Nations Charter, which allows only two reasons to go to war, and that is if you are invaded, if you do have a defensive war defending your country, and or if the Security Council authorizes it.
And once you're in the military, it puts you in a sort of awkward position if you're given orders to shoot or bomb or something like that, the military, from the start, the drill that you have to follow orders. That's a real big important sort of thing.
Yet.
I don't know if they actually, in modern sort of basic training, if they actually mention at all that you don't have to follow the legal orders.
I would doubt it. But we do have instances in our history of prosecuting people who defended by saying I was just following orders. We prosecuted the commandant of the Andersonville prison camp at the end of the Civil War, who was given nothing but a couple cans of beans to take care of thousands of Union soldiers who were prisoners of war, and they were sleeping in trenches without a blanket and walking skeletons. And his defense was, I was following orders. And we said, no, that doesn't work. Nuremberg, same thing at Nuremberg. So it's a big, heavy burden. And what we know is that the enlisted people who are involved are the ones who are going to be taken to court-martial for doing some atrocity, and yet and they will not be able to say, I was just following orders. That is no excuse under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It says specifically that a refusal to follow an unlawful order is a defense. But boy, what a burden to try to decide that when you're in the field with your team and follow, and you have to rely on the orders of a superior officer. What a burden.
Well, or that, that some of your comrades are shooting people. You may not shoot civilians, but they are, and under Uniform Code of Military Justice, you're obliged to report that. It's also, as I mentioned earlier, illegal under the Geneva Convention and the United Nations protocols. For me, as an interrogator linguist in Vietnam, intelligence analyst, I was lucky. I was able to walk away from some of this stuff. And did, had I been a little bit more heroic, I would have reported these things, not just Americans, but also our comrades, the Arvins. So it's kind of a hard thing to do in a combat in the military in a combat situation. You could possibly end up getting shot yourself,
Exactly.
if it's broad situation. In reference to interrogation, we're all familiar with the images from Abu Ghraib, where they had these hooded people were tortured, and I'd just like to say that the Bush administration got, I think it was Wu, who was a University of California philosophy or instructor. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what his specialty was. Maybe a legal. He was the one who said that enhanced torture is not torture. Enhanced
Yes,
torture, and
enhanced.
it is very, very clear what is and what isn't according to the military Uniform Code of Military Justice, and their rules for treating prisoners, for example. And but you know they the part of the legal system of the military and actually the civilian says, well, these aren't really our co combatants. They're not co military combatants, so we can torture them, which is it's sort of like white is black and black is white,
Exactly. Alternate facts are not facts.
So, some of the people do, and they're actually, I think, in the case of Abu Ghraib, there was a lieutenant colonel and maybe a colonel who was reprimanded, not discharged, but there was not any real repercussions about that sort of thing. And you know, that's sort of people around the world, they say, well, the Americans are, they torture people. Well, apparently we did, and that's not a good look for American soldiers anywhere in the world.
No.
Yeah.
So we have all the eighth question, sir, at least in this military IQ test we've got, is what's the most important question to ask a military recruiter? And we have a suggestion. Will I get to see the world? Will I get to decide what wars to fight? Do I have to kill people? Might I be killed? Those are all pretty good questions, really. I don't know about getting to see the world as maybe if you're a sailor, you might be, that's a better sort of
Yeah,
thing.
that's the motto for recruiters and for sailors. And I can tell you that the largest number of my cases were unauthorized absence or AWOL for kids who thought they were going to be going on adventures, exotic adventures in Liberty and in Hawaii, and then, maybe Australia or Europe. And instead, they spent 3 years doing chipping paint on a ship that was in dry dock in the Bremerton shipyard, or being fire watch for the ongoing construction things, and bored out of their tiny little minds, so that they ended up going home. And so most of the when I was doing criminal law for legal services, that most of my cases were unauthorized absence or AWOL. So that's a good question to
Yeah,
ask your
yeah.
recruiter.
You know, one of the questions, one of the things that we should probably also include is, how much educational benefits do I get? And as I mentioned earlier, to get the full benefits, you've got to do 36 months active, and many people do not satisfy that requirement. Actually, they're sometimes in case they get up get. Dishonorable discharges, in which case you're not ineligible for any benefits whatsoever.
More likely to blow a knee out in basic training for like Marines. That's basic training is pretty intense, and a lot of people don't make it through basic training and have like I have a friend who had a knee injury, and that was the end of her time. So yeah, I
Well,
don't know. I can't remember the other ones. Oh, I'm sorry, Dan.
no. Well, one of the, I think the main point of those things to ask a recruiter, they'll probably give you the straight military answer of, and not the nuance, that the fine print of the enlistment contract says basically that nothing is guaranteed and could be subject to change depending on military needs. So you think you're going to be back of the front in a desk somewhere performing your military duty? Well, it might work out that way, but maybe not. You could be up in the front lines, helping or carrying a rifle. So that's recruiters are not going to tell kids about that. And so the answers that they give are, need to be qualified. And I think that's what we can do to inform possible candidates that they need to know that things are could change in the military. No matter what your recruiter says, no matter what you signed up for, those things could change.
And
And
training
as I
is one.
mentioned earlier, the recruiters have had in the past a very bad record of lying to students. That is not so much a record because of public spotlight on this characteristic of recruiters, that they've cleaned up their act. And also, they mean, according to the United Uniform Code of Military Justice, for a recruiter or anybody else in charge of soldiers, lying to people is illegal under the UCMJ.
Yeah, recruiter misconduct was a defense I used when I was a military lawyer. Kid who had allergies, and the recruiter he said he was allergic to bees, and the recruiter told him, "Ain't no bees at sea, son." So that was the line that got a lot of laughs in the courtroom. He was allergic to everything, wool blankets, all sorts of things, and he made it through basic training and started like literally blowing up when he was. So anyway, it was administrative discharge for medical reasons, but we had some other cases where there was really egregious misconduct by taking somebody in who was not. It was not a suitable fit.
Did you ever run across any of those cases, Dan? People shouldn't have been in the military. Dan was a medic for
Engineer Battalion. No, I can't think of
Well,
any
I had. I remember
that.
seeing one case, one guy transferred into our unit in Vietnam, and he could barely walk up the stairs. His legs were not working well at all. And how he made it through basic and what have you, getting to Vietnam with that sort of liability. I mean, he was a liability to himself. So, anyway, the I've got a few more minutes here. I'm going to have to add up a little bit, sort of what I missed in the first part of it, that this is being broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM in Seattle, and the Veterans for Peace Daniel Ellsberg Chapter radio show. And we would hope that this video would be useful to not only to chapter members, but also to people who are thinking of getting involved in counter-recruiting. Two of the most important things to do. I mean, we think that this military IQ test is a good tool for connecting with students. The questions, because each one of these questions that we've gone through is a can be a discussion and a conversation in itself. And it can talk about other things, like, for example, military pollution, which is rampant. In any event, it should be a very useful tool to new people to counter recruiting, and to chapters that are looking for something to actually a hook to deal with getting students involved in questioning whether or not to join the military. I'll let it
It
go
was
at
a
that.
great tool when I was at Franklin High School. It was a great tool for talking to students. So, great conversation starter. I think it's really a useful tool.
And again, this is available on the VFP92.org website. The full you can download the full IQ test with answers, suggested answers, and the also there are some downloadable memorandums from the Seattle School District outlining recruiter requirements for visiting schools, which is an important. We have to sort of re recommend and go back with over these things because of schools and or the because of turnover in the schools. They don't actually always know what their own district's regulations are. So one of the things that you have to do is remind them of this is what the school district policies are. So anyway, that's it for now. Hopefully this is going to be useful to people who are looking at, and this is hopefully it's going to be just enough.